These are three powerful advocates who become essential voices for their respective corners of South Africa. First, we have a man who's part of the furniture of our democracy, Dr. Corné Mulder. He's the longest-serving member of parliament with over 36 years of uninterrupted service. And he's saying, but he's not just a political survivor, he's a constitutional scholar who earned his doctorate in law at the age of 26 and was deeply involved in writing sections of South Africa's new constitution. He's also the leader of the Freedom Front Plus Party, a party that is playing an ever-increasing role in South African politics and often has been described as the only adult in the room when it came to some of those political meetings. Next, a man who has taken the voice of the South African farmer from the fields of Limpopo to the corridors of global power, Theo de Jager. Many know him as a leader in organized agriculture, but few realize that he served as president of the World Farmers Organization, representing agricultural producers across the globe. I think that's where we met. In Davos. There we go. Yeah. He was there as the representing agriculture, not from South Africa, but the whole world. Interestingly, he was a full-time farmer. Before he was a full-time farmer, he spent years as a control analyst at the State Security Council and a negotiation consultant for mining houses. Boy, could they have used you recently. And finally, the relentless champion for employers. And he is relentless. Gerard Papenfuss of NIASA. He's the voice holding the line for business, big and small. While he's now a formidable opponent of restrictive labor policies, his background isn't what you might expect. He's got a passion for writing and poetry, and in a former life was a newspaper editor who would occasionally publish his own poems on the pages he edited. This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst. So there's the three amigos who have been called treasonous, dreadful, unpatriotic to our country. Corné, you sit with these guys who've been accusing you of that in Parliament for 36 years. What are they getting at?
Alec, thank you for the opportunity. It's a privilege to be here with my two colleagues. I must just start off by saying that the reference of amigos are not so well received in the United States in the Trump administration. You'll understand what I'm saying. But when we came back, we earned the title of being three amigos. Now, we live in a very interesting time, a fantastic time at the moment. And I know there's a lot of negativism and people sometimes become despondent. The three of us brought the message of absolute positivity. And that's what we also took to the United States. We didn't go there, and that specifically, you remember, before we went, some other delegations did go to the United States prior to our visit. We didn't decide that we would like to go. We were invited to come to the United States, and we were presented there as an Afrikaner leadership group. And we said from the beginning, we realized we don't represent all Afrikaners, but we didn't go there just to purely represent the Afrikaner. We represented South Africa. And we were a little bit arrogant. When we got there, we said to the Americans, you know, the problem at home is there's a vacuum of leadership in South Africa. And the three of us intend to step into that vacuum and give leadership on behalf of the country. And that was very well received in the United States, I can assure you. Because you must remember, not long before we went, there was this visit to the Oval Office by another delegation. And I said to the Americans, I was wondering what the viewership was of that specific meeting. We told the Americans, and you could assist us, we need to print a T-shirt, which will be very popular, and it should only say, dim the lights. I believe that will be quite popular if we try to do that. No, the difference is this, and that's an interesting thing, Alec. Some of the other delegations that went and came back were accused of being treasonous, of being disloyal to South Africa. We did not have any of that. Nothing, none whatsoever. Why? We did not go there to slander anyone. We did not go there to break down our country or to do anything negative. We went with a simple message. South Africa can and should be a model, fantastic country, and we should be a winning nation. That's what we want. However, there are some challenges that needs to be addressed. And then we started unpacking those kind of challenges. And we found a very accommodative audience, be that in the White House, in the Senate, at the State Department, at the House of Representatives, everywhere we went. And that was a constructive and a positive message. There was no negativity, and we came back. And unlike some of our friends and colleagues in other delegations, we are currently not being investigated for high treason. Maybe part of that is 37 years experience in Parliament. I know how to deal with those guys. Let me stop there.
Theo, you've operated on a global stage, as I mentioned in the introduction. So you know not just the Americans, but people from all over the world. When you went there into what for many South Africans would appear to be the lion's den, how were you strategizing to get the best possible deal for our country?
It did not all start with a flight ticket to Washington. It actually started in Gerard's office on a Sunday afternoon. It was about a week before the president and Johan Rupert and the golfers went across. We were asked by a group of business people in Washington to write a letter from a business angle, to say the policies in our country is restricting entrepreneurship in this way and this way. And they committed to have that letter on Trump's desk in the week or the few days before President Ramaphosa got there. So we sat until late that evening. If you want to write a letter, you should get one to write it. It's not that easy to write amongst three. We actually had more people assisting. And it was from that letter that the invitation came. Now,
what did the letter say?
Well, we said, you have no idea how hard it is to do business here under these conditions. You have no idea of the risks involved in this policy environment. And we need policy changes. And it's hard to bring it about through the political process here because of the numbers and the kind of government we have now. A coalition government or a government of national unity is always a weaker government. And we can't wait until a next election. So we need assistance from elsewhere too. But we also said we want to bring a value proposition. If your problem is in the USA and in Europe that people are flocking onto your shores because they are running away from poverty and hunger, we come from a continent where we know poverty and hunger. And we know nothing stops a hungry man, no fence, and no border, no sea. But we can keep them there, because we have 370 years of experience to fight poverty and hunger. There's only one way to win this battle, and that's by creating wealth. There's no other way. And that nothing can create more wealth in a shorter space of time and on a broader basis than agriculture can. We have a network of South African, Zimbabwean, and Namibian farmers. There are 4,800 of them in a network spanning across 44 countries today. And we don't ask grants. We don't ask any handouts. If we could have access to commercial financing, because it's hard to find financing elsewhere in Africa. Remember, there's only four countries where you can own farmland south of the Sahara. And if you do not have a title deed, you do not have collateral for production loans. So help us to create the opportunities in Africa, and we can keep them there.
Is Zimbabwe one of those four countries?
No. It is South Africa and Namibia, where we have free title, and small pockets of Botswana, small pockets of Zambia. In the rest, our farmers who are farming there are using their South African farms to put up as collateral for
production loans.
So Gerard, they hijacked your meeting to take it into the agricultural sector. I mean, you with industry, you with business, with manufacturing, and so on. Did you get a word in at least edgeways onto Trump's desk?
Yeah, the one thing we realized, and now we had sufficient opportunity to explain the impact of radical economic transformation, because that is indeed playing out in South Africa, and now faster than ever. It's strange that since the June use in place, the pace of transformation has substantially increased. And I heard Davi say the ANC is not applying the NDR, but they are. And what you see there, and they do it on a race basis, and that is they are settling a historic national grievance, apartheid imperialism. And so I think the thing that we confirmed, because the Americans know everything what's happening, and they know more than what we know. And so, you know, I think they know these things, but I think we brought some emotion to them, how it works, what the impact is of BEE, what it means on the ground, and now employment equity, the prospects of a white person is limited to get work, and it will substantially increase over the years to come if this thing is happening. And so if you are forced out of the workplace and you start your own business, then soon you'll be faced with a situation where you will have to get in a partner, not of your choice. And now that is, you know, when you tell the story, although they know it, they say, but this is impossible. It cannot happen. How can it happen? They don't understand this principle. So although they know it, they don't know the emotion, the raw emotion behind this. You know, when Trump was standing there to tarmac right at the beginning, where he said there are terrible things happening in South Africa. And he said two things. There's a genocide happening. And he also said there are expropriation of land without compensation. You know, he was challenged. They said, but what? It's not happening. Well, what he knows is not what he reads in newspapers. They don't only read what's happening here. They listen to the ANC. They know what's happening in the inner circles of the ANC. They hear what they're planning. So, you know, typical Trump, I think they tried to explain to him what's happening, and he listened for 30 seconds and he says, no, I hear enough, and I see what they're doing, and he said what he said. The point is they know what's happening, and they do not find this, that is totally unacceptable for them. But so, yeah, and we had ample opportunity from platform to platform, both of us, not both of us, the three of us, he's excluded from that. Now, the three of us repeated this message on each and every platform and each and every meeting.
Cornet, it's so interesting when you listen to members of the public. They make assumptions of people who are speaking out. Oh, no, he's stupid. He doesn't know what's going on. Ah, Trump hasn't got a clue what's happening. And then you get these teenage scribblers who repeat that kind of assumption, and it often surprises me. Socrates said the beginning of wisdom is to realize that you know nothing, but it's almost like we've got an infestation of people who know everything. Now, how, from your perspective, do you, two big things? Davi Ruit spoke about the National Democratic Revolution and what Anthea Jeffrey has been, what she spoke about here at, in fact, in this session last in March, that it is alive and well, and you've heard Gerard say the same thing. Not everybody agrees that that is the case. So starting with that. But the second thing is what Gerard now said about Trump being well informed. You've had enough time to engage with the man, to engage with other people around him. Does he know what's going on, or is he just shooting from the hip?
You don't become president of the United States if you don't have something in you that is strong, and that is, you don't just become president. And the interesting thing is, I think in his first term as president, he came in as a business person from the outside. He was not a politician, and he found it overwhelming. And obviously, everybody was out to get him. When he came in for his second term, he's determined to do what he wants to do. Whether we like it or not, he's determined, and he's going to do that. And he started off at an immense pace. That is where it basically started. If you remember correctly with regard to South Africa, he started off in the beginning of the year when he issued that executive order. We were all asleep on a Friday night. It was Friday afternoon in the United States. When he woke up on the Saturday morning, there was that executive statement. And I sometimes say, if you look at the executive statement, he dealt with the claim of genocide, the claim of different things, expropriation, etc. But I think the most vital mistake the ANC government made, why did Trump put his magnifying glass on South Africa, was because of the court case against the State of Israel. And if you understand the international political sphere and the influence of Israel and the Jewish community internationally, you'll understand why. So the reality is that these things are playing out. Trump knows exactly what he's going to do. He's absolutely determined. When we, and I must say, we were really welcomed with open arms. The people that assisted us in Washington said, and those were people who were in South Africa's Foreign Service prior to 1994 and after 1994. They've said they've never had it so easy to get doors to open for a delegation to get engagements when we went. And that was in the White House, in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, the State Department. We spoke to four policy institutes, two farming bureaus, some business people, etc. And the message that came from America across the board was, we want to engage with South Africa. We want to trade. We want to use South Africa and be part of the investments, the direct foreign investment. And you must remember now, from the Trump administration's perspective, they take note of what China is doing in Africa. And they want to counter that, not with aid, but with serious trade. South Africa remains the United States' biggest trading partner in Africa. So they want to reach out. But then they say there are these non-tariff barriers, basically. And if I can just mention, Theo mentioned now, when we wrote that the first letter, we had the same experience after our visit to the White House when we wanted to issue a statement. a group of people cannot write a statement. A group of people can't write a letter. They say that's the reason why a giraffe looks like a giraffe, because it was developed by a committee. So you understand, you can't do that. But even when, after the meeting in the White House, when we came out, we wrote the statement which we issued. And if I can just say about that meeting specifically, we had a normal good discussion. At the end of the meeting, the White House staff put the document on the table and said, now you must listen to us. These are our four preconditions to reset relations with South Africa. And you all know what it was about. It was about rural security. It was about kill the boer, kill the farmer. And then on the economic side, it was no expropriation without compensation, and compensation being free market value after the legal process. And then the whole question of black economic empowerment. And when we wrote the statement, before we issued it that evening, we sent it back to the White House and said, we don't want to speak on your behalf and make a mistake. Are you happy with this wording? They changed two words, and then it was basically issued. On the South African side, the government reacted to say, no, we don't believe that. Governments don't work through civil society, etc. Now, at the moment, President yesterday said they are in Washington. Yes, I know they are there. Alistair Reisters and others are there. But they are being told, we can talk about the deal, but there are some outstanding non-tariff barriers, and those deal with these political issues.
Before, and I'd like to get all three of your views on this. Would the conversations that Cyril Ramaphosa had in Zimbabwe, and in particular his praising of the land reform process there, have come into the conversations in Washington now?
Yes, it does. Don't make a mistake. There's a thing called WhatsApp. And that thing called WhatsApp is quite handy. We do have some friends in Washington that we talk to on a daily basis. But I just want to make one point. And I know
you talk to people in Washington on a daily basis?
Yes.
South Africa?
Yes. I've spoken to a gentleman who's in charge of all the administrative personnel of the Republican Party but while we were having dinner tonight, because there's most likely the hearing for the appointment, the confirmation hearing of the American ambassador to South Africa, Brent Purcell, will take place either today or tomorrow in the Senate. Now, just with regard to the Zimbabwe statement, we must understand that you cannot take seriously any words that comes from the ANC. Let me give you an example. When President Ramaphosa is confronted in the Oval Office to say, but what about expropriation without compensation? What do you say about that? What was his response? No, no, no. We've got a constitution. There's a section 25 that protects property rights. Whoa. It was your party, Mr. President, who a year ago tried to amend section 25 to make expropriation possible. Don't try to tell President Trump now that you're against that. And then you go to Zimbabwe now and say other things again. So words are there to be used depending on the situation at the moment. But obviously, the United States take these things seriously and they know exactly what's going on.
What is your constituency, the agricultural, organized agriculture in South Africa, think about what the South African president said in Zimbabwe?
My organization, SAI, is the Southern African Agri Initiative. So our membership spans across the whole of Southern Africa. We are by far the biggest voice for farmers in Zimbabwe too. Not only the white farmers who are still farming there are still 126 of them, but also those who lost their land since 2000. But that's not where it started. It actually started with the 600 farms they took in Matabili land during the Gukurundi massacres. And we also have them as members. So when we went to Washington, at every one of our 14 meetings, we also discussed the compensation issue in Zimbabwe, ZEDIRA, which is the Sanctions Act, the equivalent of what Johnson is driving now against South Africa, but also the Magnitsky sanctions. It was very interesting for us when...
Sorry, just explain those, Theo. What the Magnitsky Act and the South African Sanctions Act. You mentioned Johnson.
Yeah.
Maybe many people here haven't heard who he is.
Yeah, so there's an act to be passed through Parliament, which will focus on action against South Africa, very similar to what we see in Zimbabwe. The Magnitsky sanctions is targeted against individuals, companies, and networks. And it's this networks that really has the sting in it. They say to us, we make them radioactive. No one can do business with them. It's a bit like BEE in South Africa. Don't think you can get around it because it also impacts on everybody with whom you do business. And they are working on lists. There was a lot of questions about lists now.
Lists
just
of what?
Lists of people.
What people?
To be targeted for.
South African people.
Yeah, yeah.
South African people?
They want names.
They want names.
Names of, but what people?
Like they.
Bad people.
At one stage, Gerard said to them, man, it's easy. There's a Zondo Commission report. You can just read through that. There's a list there. But the day before we left, Professor William Gumede from WITS published a report in which he said that the trillion rand was exchanged between only 100 people. They wanted to know from us, do you know who those 100 people are? Can you get your hands on that list? So they are at the moment, they are already through Parliament's committees. And now we had a dinner last week with one of the high-ranking officials in the White House here in Pretoria. And they explained to us what the rest of the process is like. So ons is op die afdraande pad also into. And I believe that can be a game changer. We are seeing it in Zimbabwe. You know, it really pulled the handbrake on ZANU-PF.
Gerard, do you want to elaborate on why it would be a game changer?
Look, you know, what happened there happened. And it's exactly as... it's exactly as Konai and Tu said. You know, I think
personal sanctions, targeted sanctions. I think there's it will be a game changer. But I'm personally not so sure whether that will be effective, whether it will have the impact that we desire. And I sense since we're back, I sense there might even be, you know, they are within those that are that's favoring us, that they think it might be counterproductive. You know,
sorry, let me understand this. So these guys have been outed by the Zondo Commission. They are criminals.
Oh yeah, no.
But I see. But by going for them, by someone going for them, it's counterproductive.
Well, you know when Mugabe, when ZANU-PF was on its weakest, that's when the land grabs actually started. They doubled down on it at that moment. So we have this danger that the ANC will be their backs against the wall, and they might respond in an extremely negative way. The we is myself. I'm concerned that we don't know exactly how it will play out. I've also in that discussion too, I don't know whether you understand the people we met with a week or two ago, that they weren't very sure whether they can get this past the Senate, because I think there's questions around this. Now, from a personal point of view, from our side, we say, you know, hammer these guys because they're a bunch of criminals. And since nobody does anything to them, don't sort them out, let the Americans sort them out. So it might be, but, you know, there might be a point that they feel they've got nothing to lose here, and that they turn. Well, they're already turning the eyes towards the East totally. I think they are doubling down. I think they've written America off. I think so.
They are trying to make a comeback in terms of normalizing relations with the United States. That's why they send the head of the defense force to Tehran in Iran. And that's why they've got joint exercises with the Chinese Navy and the Russian Navy. No, they realize the importance of the United States. You cannot ignore the United States. The president yesterday in Parliament, in response to a question, indicated that South Africa is about to appoint our new ambassador to the United States. He didn't mention a name. He said it will be somebody with experience, etc., etc. Let me take a guess. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. If I'm right, you will know I told you so. I have an idea. It could be a gentleman called Martinus Kortbroek van Schalkwyk, but I'm not sure.
You are joking.
Well, let's wait and see. The announcement will be soon. I think
you are joking.
No, I'm not.
You're serious?
I'm serious. Maybe I'm completely wrong. Then I'll accept that. But I may be right. Let's see.
Would he be on the shortlist?
He is on the shortlist.
What's his credentials?
His credentials is that he was an ambassador, I think, in Rome or Athens, and then in Australia, and he joined the ANC. That's a very good CV to hand in. No, it's a possibility. No, I think the reality is that the ANC is trying to track a little bit back with regard to the United States. But it's not going to be that simple. Trump is very adamant. And if you look at Africa, for example, there are only three countries in Africa that's got the maximum tariffs: South Africa, Nigeria, and I think Lesotho got 30%. The rest got 15%. All our neighboring states in Southern Africa has got 15%. I think the Trump administration is determined to make a point.
Let's get back to that question that I had earlier, which we didn't get to, your constituency, the farmers of South Africa. These are the people who are ensuring that we're fed in this country. How are they feeling about the whole situation, and in particular of the light of the recent Zimbabwe land grab was a really good thing?
Remember, food security does not mean that any country produces everything it consumes. No country does that today. Today, food security hinges on trade. Food security today means that a country must produce enough of that in which it has a competitive advantage so that it can exchange from the food basket those products in which he does not have a competitive advantage. So trade is extremely important to us. And we produce in South Africa into three markets. Europe and the USA only produce into two markets, the middle class and the upper market. We also have a very big informal market, or the poorer section of the market. But you need to be able to trade. And although our trade in agricultural products, mostly wine and nuts and fruit, although it's only 4% of our total exports in agriculture, it's the most important 4%, because it is a very affluent market. And we pleaded at every meeting that we should not punish farmers who are really supportive of US policies in general. So the farmers are holding their hearts for the impact of this trade or these tariffs. It knocks us out of the market, especially in macadamia nuts, almonds, and wine. And it's not that easy as the journalists make it, of finding alternative markets. One evening, we had a dinner with the business people who invited us and who asked us to write that letter in the most expensive restaurant. When they gave us the menus, I said to them, we cannot order these steaks. So I asked our host, what would you recommend? But he went for an even more expensive one. And during the course of the evening, we realized that all of them have property in South Africa, Serengeti and there in Cape Town. All of them are importing food and doing the distribution in the US. So the one guy has a contract with Walmart. And they complained about how difficult it is for them to source in certain times of the year. When he heard that I also farm lychees, he said, I'll take every lychee you produce this year. Last year, I could not even meet 10% of my order. And it is so cheap. The fact is that now we will be more expensive than all our competitors in the Southern Hemisphere. So although the farmers in general, remember, in every country, no matter where you go in the world, farmers are the more conservative part of society. Not necessarily conservative in political terms, often that too, or in religious terms, often that too. But farmers are always conservative in terms of family values, as long as agriculture is family-based. So farmers in general is very positive about the impact of the second Trump administration on geopolitics, but we are bleeding because of these tariffs.
And I've got to wonder what they say to you when they see you at meetings. You know, you guys, the three amigos, went off to Washington. You went to go and represent a constituency who've now been punished. Could they have not have got? I mean, do they not ask you, why didn't you get us a pass there?
Well, we are still trying to get that pass. Hey, why do you think we took that guy for dinner? We are still, because there's not only one tariff. Cars only have 25%. Julle staal ouens het
50.
Yeah. And raw materials go without tariffs. So we are trying to influence them to exclude agricultural products.
But if they like you so much, not just to eat your steaks, but they like you so much there in Washington, why didn't they make an exception, Cornet?
If I may say, I think we must understand that the Trump administration is very serious about what they want to achieve. And it's unfortunate, but we have to bear it out. We all are going to suffer maybe for a short period, because we need to get a regime change in South Africa. And in order to get that, they are putting a maximum pressure on the current ANC government. And they're not going to relinquish that. They're not going to step back from that. It may take a while. If I can use one example, and I said that during dinner to someone, I remember in the previous century, in 1985, the previous government, at that stage, and there were many circumstances and reasons for that, but at that stage, around 1985, the international community decided that the previous government, you are the bad guys. And from that moment on, it was a downward spiral to the end. And there was nothing you could do to change the perception. That is where the ANC is now. And they can try whatever they like. It's a downward spiral until the end. And unfortunately, we are all part of what may happen. But the point that we made was don't punish our people. Don't punish the good people in South Africa. Focus on the leadership. And that's what they're exactly going to do with specialized, specific sanctions on leaders.
Now, you've walked those corridors forever. You heard André de Ruyter today, I hope, when André said that FW was given a hospital pass, but there was something big that changed. And he was given the opportunity to transform this country's trajectory. Is Ramaphosa able to accept that kind of guidance from who knows who, but no. Somebody even from above?
No, he's not able to do that. I'm absolutely, that's on the political side. I'm absolutely convinced the ANC is not able to self-correct. They will not do that. All the best arguments in the world will not convince them of a different path. No. The solution is somewhere else, and that somebody else, I think Davi mentioned it earlier today, the solution is at the ballot box. That's what you've got to do. There's no other way. That's a democratic way. We need to get you. Remember in the last election, the party that won the election was the people that did not go out and vote. That's the challenge.
We've got some questions. Talal Salim asks a question for you, Corné. What do people in the US political corridors think of Western Cape independence? You're in the right place.
Well, we are working on that as well. No, it's ironic. If we succeed in turning South Africa around, the idea and the notion of Western Cape independence will diminish. If we do not succeed in turning South Africa nationally around, it will obviously get stronger and stronger. But the reality is the answer lies in that kind of idea. Why should everything be centralized and not devolutionized and in terms of a federal kind of structure? So there's on more than one occasion in the United States, they said to us when we spoke, and as I've said, we went there to say there's a leadership vacuum, we're going to fill that, and South Africa should have made a proposal in terms of a trade deal. We'll make one on their behalf. And quite often they said, you must think much bigger than poultry or this or that. Think in bigger terms. And that was part of our proposal, was to say we need to think in a geopolitical sense. For example, if you look at the United States in terms of what is in their national interest, there are three entry points into the Southern Atlantic. It's around Argentina, it's around the Cape of Good Hope, and it's through the Panama Canal. There should be a new agreement between those two countries, so those three countries, to say, how do we safeguard what's happening in the South Atlantic, because the Americans are very much aware of the threat from China, who's now developing a deep blue sea, a navy, etc. So I think in the end, if you need that kind of thing, you need one superpower, one sovereign big state to recognize that. Western Cape independence is a reality that could develop. It doesn't happen overnight. It could happen overnight. Let me use an example. When we saw what happened in KZN about 3 years ago, overnight, it was complete chaos. That was directed at businesses, etc. We know where we are. It could be tomorrow against minorities. And then overnight, something could happen in that instance. And who knows what could change South Africa if Simonstown becomes a naval base in cooperation with the United States and we have some nice aircraft carriers with lots of planes and stuff.
This question is from Rob Hersoff for the Three Amigos. Have Ernst Rutz and I had a meaningful impact on our various US podcast tours, David Rubin, Patrick Bet David, Jordan Peterson, etc.?
What is the question?
The question is, did Rob Hersoff and Ernst Rutz have a meaningful impact on their various US podcast tours with people like David Rubin, Patrick Bet David, Jordan Peterson, and so on?
If I may, Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. The days of mainstream media, I won't say it's over, but I'll say it's very much limited. The new way to communicate with people are through podcasts. They've got and media influencers. They've got huge influence. If you look at the subscription of some of the newspapers and compare that to podcasters, you can't compare the two. So it had huge impact, and it should still be. And if they can, they should continue with that, because that's the way to get the message across. That's how you internationalize a plight of a people or a plight of a country, etc., and expose the wrongdoers, which we need to do. The days of everybody saying kumbaya about the ANC are over.
But the point, I guess, being the American zeitgeist towards South Africa, such that it is, has been influenced by these kind of developments?
For sure. Gordon, you said now that we also met with the two agricultural unions in the USA, Farm Bureau and the National Farmers Union. I know those guys. I spent years with them in the World Farmers Organization. There was always an American on my board since I became president there. And we would often discuss the situation here in South Africa and next door in Zimbabwe. But they only heard that story from me. And hearing the same story from Rob, hearing it from Aaron's and other podcasters, they realized that there is something much deeper going on here. And they would ask questions on the facts which were shared by Rob and Aaron's and the others. But not only there, also here, I only met Rob for the first time today. But I was looking for him for a long time. I wanted to say to him, listen, you cannot whip up the farmers, because after the meeting, when they have a braai, then they would quote him and ask me the questions about it. The impact of podcasts on the psyche of our farmers can never be underestimated.
Positive or negative?
You don't need to give farmers good news to make them positive. They just want to hear the truth. And they want to believe that there's somebody who understands the undercurrents and who's trying to get handles on it. Can I just say on that point too? And I'm saying that insofar as I meet with farmers' organizations from Cape Town to Messina and from Durban to Port Nolloth every week of my life. The current generation of farmers, the older generation, my generation, are hellbound to get this country on its feet again in our lifetime. And they believe it can be done if enough of us stand together.
We turn up every day, don't we? We turn up every day. Gary Liebenberg's question, how many farmers do you think will take up the offer of refugee status and move across to the US?
Can I also take the first bite on the apple there? When AfriForum and Solidarity said that they are not going to assist in this process because they want Afrikaners to stay here, we in SAI, because we are involved with the farmers who are farming elsewhere in Africa, and we service embassies every week. We have created a capacity to service embassies. We decided that we will keep a list of those who want to go and keep contact with them. And we have just under 1,000 on that list at the moment, of which only 5 are really farmers, still active farmers. They are not really farmers who want to go. There are 3 groups on that list. The biggest group are youngsters who work there every year, the H2A program. We try to keep track on them, and we thought there were 16,200 this year, but there are 25,000 of them. And they earn dollar there, and they come back with some money in the pockets. But much more important, they come back with valuable experience on high-tech machines, and they are exposed to management models on farms, which is still unknown to us.
And they feel they understand the system there. And, you know, the barriers to entry in our profession is so high now. It's nearly impossible for a youngster to start farming if you do not inherit the farm. So they want to stay there to be farmers. Then there's a smaller group, middle-aged people, heads of families who fell victim to BEE. They were middle management, silo, or cooperative floor managers, and they've lost their jobs, and they don't see a future for themselves here. They don't think they will get the job again because of BEE. And then there are those, it's fortunately a very small group, but a very significant group who were victims of farm attacks. There's the one guy, he farmed in the Solnachtsrivier Valley. There was a farm attack, and they killed his mom and his daughter. And then a year later, there was another one in which they killed his wife. Now, we gave him assistance, berading, counseling. But the psychiatrist said to us, it's not really helping very much. Now, that guy also said, I want to get out of here. And who are we to say to him, Niemann, bait fast?
Could I just add, sorry, about the refugee thing? One point. In the letter, I also sent a letter to President Trump, and I thanked him for reaching out specifically to the Afrikaners and the farmers offering refugee status, which he later on expanded to all minorities in South Africa. But while we were there, I made the following point, and I thought it was relevant. 50 years ago, exactly 50 years ago, 1975, the Portuguese government fell in Portugal, and because of that, Portugal lost its colonies in Angola and Mozambique. And thousands of Portuguese people from Angola and Mozambique streamed to South Africa, 1975. At that stage, my father was the Minister of Interior in South Africa, and you'll find some clips on YouTube where he spoke dealing with those issues at that stage. I said to the Americans, thank you very much for the offer, but know this, we are going back home and we're going to do everything in our power that we never need to make use of refugee status in the United States, because we want to create a future here in South Africa.
Mm. Clarette, within the NIASA grouping, we were having a chat over dinner, and you said that 40 businesses a day from your members were closing. Are those people who lose their businesses through poor economics or whatever other reason, are those people wanting to go over and take advantage of this refugee opportunity?
I don't think so. There might be, but I don't pick up that's the case. I think the invitation isn't that wide, and for a businessman, those that wants to go in any event. I don't think there's so many. I think it's more out of the groupings that Tu is referring to. It's a situation. I told Alec last night that just in the ASOS clientele, we're losing 30 to 40 companies a month that close their doors. There are many reasons for that. It's overall poor economic, bad industrial policy that's causing that. And that's a discussion on its own. But, I mean, it's tough. It's really tough. And it's not only hitting white people, you know, it's hitting everybody. It's hitting people on the different levels of society in different manners. But it's tough.
Bruce Morgan's question is, the opposition parties are often not far apart. Why can the opposition parties not put their pride in their pocket and have a united effort to beat the ANC?
Yes. No, I understand that. And that is a feeling that comes across the board from many people. I think the thing that you need to understand is the following. Our electoral system is a system of proportional representation, meaning each and every vote counts. So you've got one or two options. The one is to create a new political party, one entity where everybody comes together and you form a new structure, and then you participate in the election as one united thing with one proportional list, etc. That's one option. The problem with that is you ask yourself the question, it's not that simple to create a new entity. It's not that simple to create a new emblem. And there are always struggles between the leaderships, etc., etc. But there is a question that says, for example, who's got the best ability to attract the votes of those rural voters in northern KZN? Maybe that's the IFP. And there are different political parties that appeal to different segments of society. But what we need to tell the electorate is, and I think we need to indicate that before an election, the following parties are prepared to cooperate and to work together in a coalition. And you know, you can vote for the party of your choice. I think we must understand that. It's very unlikely that ever again we're going to have one specific party alone that will attain a majority. We saw a number of coalitions after the last election in some of the metros and in the Western Cape. My prediction is we're going to see coalitions throughout South Africa, and we need to form governments of the good people against the bad people, and that can be done.
I've got to ask you about Action SA and their... Because before the election, they would certainly have said anyone but the ANC. And now we've seen things have gone a little bit awry as far as that promise was concerned.
Yes. Parties come and go. And sometimes parties will position themselves with a specific position, a specific point of view, and position themselves against. And then you find at some stage that your hatred for another party is so strong and it overshadows all the things that you believe that you cooperate with somebody else to your own detriment. But the electorate does have a way of punishing that kind of behavior in an election. So I'm concerned about that. But it also seems that the Action SA as a party has moved into a different kind of seeking support from different communities as such. My prediction is that I think the ANC is going to do very badly in the coming election next year, and we will get some good coalitions in many of the municipalities and of the metros.
Pete asks, is our DA leader as the Minister of Agriculture assisting or handicapping the interests of South African farmers? That's from Pete Carolyn.
What do you mean?
You know, agriculture is a business. Every farmer is a business. And the business must be profitable. That's the most important part of it. So we are fighting for the profitability of our farms, especially the smaller and medium-scale farms.
He's, of course, not answering.
And some No, I'm on my way there. I'm trying to do it politically smart. Give me a chance.
John denies that he knows you. Let me just help you.
Let me tell you, I will answer you this way. Something which was wrong under the ANC is not right just because the DA is now the minister. We need a change of policies. We need policies which is conducive to profitable agriculture. And most certainly, threats of expropriation without compensation and BEE. I mean, how do you BEE a family farm? What's even the moral foundation of trying to put pressure on a family farm to get in partners? It's hard enough for a father and his son to farm together. What to say a partner which you did not want in this business? So we are scrumming against policies which is coming a long way, and we are putting pressure on the minister too to keep to his party's policies which they expressed prior to the previous election.
That's very interesting. So he is not implementing the policies of his party in agriculture. He's implementing the existing policies, i.e. the policies of the ANC.
What they say when we confront him, he says that there's muscle memory in his department. And it is so, you know. I think for a minister to come from outside the ANC and inherit department like that without making changes to the top structure, because other ministers have
fired senior officials and replaced them. It has not happened in agriculture. And we are really being mimed with, for example, foot and mouth disease at the moment. It is a crisis. Every day farmers would call and say, I need to pay my Kuperasi skuld at the end of the month. I need to pay my children's university fees by the end of the month. And I plan to sell these cattle, and now I can't. Now, the issue is not that we've lost our handles on this disease. Why did we lose the capacity to produce the vaccines in the first place? Why must we import it from Botswana? And what happens in this value chain, from what we heard, what our colleagues in Botswana pays for the vaccines and what we are paying for it, somebody is making huge profits in this process. So we, the farmers, want to see real action to cover the pain they have in seeing their businesses being destroyed because of food now.
I can see why John Steenhuisen says he doesn't know you.
Alec, I know our time is running out, but I want you to give me a minute before we close, just to give you a lighter moment of our visit when you think
you've each got a minute to close. So
okay, let me just tell a quick story. In Washington, there are lots of people moving around in big black limousines and stuff. So in our movements, we also use some smart Uber things that looks like these big black SUVs. And we all dressed up very nicely with ties going around. So we decided at one stage, it's time to have some fun. And we decided we're going to pretend that Gerard is the VIP and the two of us are the bodyguards. So here arrives the limousine and we open the door and we escort Gerard safely in before anyone can hurt him. And we're on our walkie-talkies and we talk, etc., etc. And the people on the pavement were very amused and wondering who this celebrity was. But I can assure you we had a lot of fun while we were doing our work.
Gerard, I know you didn't get a word in edgeways here. Was it different in Washington?
No, it was. We had it was very constructive. Just an interesting story. The first time we walked into the corridors of Congress, what I noticed is groups of people standing and talking, not like two or three people just having a chat, but formal meetings, groups. Various groups standing. And we were at a meeting with a congressman, and he was supposed to be there. He couldn't make it. And then we met with his staff, and then the message came, he needs his office urgently. So they said to us, we'll continue the meeting in a corridor. And that's what happened. And that's what I realized. All these Congress and Senate offices are quite small. Well, that's too small for the congressman or a senator and his staff, but they are squeezed into those offices. So where do they meet? In the corridor. And that's where these groups stand, and it's short meetings, very effective meetings, making notes, making decisions. They're in the corridor, and you see that's where they meet, in the corridor. There's no boardrooms with coffee and rust like we do in South Africa. You do it in the corridor. Yeah, very, very interesting.
And you need to take that back to NIASA members. Maybe it'll assist with their meetings.
Yeah, and now we'll go back to the coffee and rust thing in South Africa.
Last word, Theo?
Yeah, just like we have seen many of the state's functions being privatized, whether it is security or hospitals, I think that we are also living in the time of the privatization of foreign policy today, because what happened there, and especially in this pinnacle moment, when they said to us, would you three be prepared to send this message to South Africa? We have tried to do it via our embassy, via your embassy. And we have told the previous delegation of the president and the golfers, these are the four conditions for resetting the relationship.
but we don't pick it up in South Africa. So will you convey this message? But we also see it in Pretoria, eh? Because we go to embassies if a farmer in Gabon has a problem with a disease, or if Frelimo shoots buffalo on a South African farmer in Mozambique. It's hard for that farmer to sort it out in Mozambique or in Gabon. It's much easier for us to do it via the embassy, yeah. But then the embassy start to ask us for favors too. They need to report every week on certain data, what's our crop estimates and that kind of stuff. And they no longer get it from the Department of Foreign Affairs. So we have created this capacity to service them with that too. And I think in our lifetime, this function of diplomacy, even between countries, will never again be only in the hands of the state.
Well, gentlemen, the diplomatic mission, unofficial, not treasonous, served us well from what you've shared with us tonight. Thank you so much. Let's give them a round of applause. Thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. Building wealth and protecting legacy since 2004. Invest better with Brenthurst.